Welcome back to another episode of our brand new podcast, City Hall Pass, hosted by myself, the counsel to the mayor, Kapel Longani. We created this forum, the first of its kind in New York City, to provide you, the general public, with a unique window into the problem-solving process at the highest levels of our city government, and to be able to share insights into key decisions as told by the trailblazing leaders who made them. And now I want to introduce my two hosts today, two women who are truly brilliant and inspire me every day, Bess Chu and Kate Coughlin.
Thanks, Kapel. Happy to be here. This is Bess Chu. I'm currently Chief of Staff to the Office of the Counsel to the Mayor.
Hi, I'm Kate Coughlin, and I currently serve as Deputy Counsel for the Office of the Counsel to the Mayor.
I want to introduce our guest for this episode, Barry Burke. Barry Burke is a New Yorker through and through who has been routinely recognized as one of the leading trial lawyers and criminal defense attorneys in the country. He's been described as one of the most high-profile and sought-after white-collar attorneys in New York and the go-to guy for white-collar trial work. Not surprisingly, he's been named as one of the top 10 lawyers in New York across all practice areas every year since 2014. Barry most recently served as special counsel to the Judiciary Committee on the House of Representatives and has been widely praised for his work in connection with the impeachment of President Trump. The New York Times described Barry as an architect of their impeachment inquiry and one of the people who worked to build the investigative framework for the House Democrats that led to the eventual impeachment of the president. In his spare time, Barry serves as chairman of the board of directors of the Coalition for the Homeless and as Mayor de Blasio's designee on Lincoln Center's board of directors. In this episode, Barry shared some fascinating behind-the-scenes stories from President Trump's impeachment and gave us a unique insight into the strategic decisions made during the subsequent trial. We hope you enjoy. So our next guest needs no introduction, but he's someone who is not only known locally as one of the best lawyers in New York City, but now known nationally after his tremendous work in the impeachment trial of Donald Trump. None other than Barry Burke. Barry, I want to welcome you to City Hall Pass. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Kapel. It's an honor to be here with you. I know all the tremendous work you're doing for the mayor and the city. So thank you for everything you're doing during these challenging times.
Well, thank you, Barry. And it's interesting. I met Barry, the first time I met him was when I was interviewing for this job. First of all, you couldn't have been nicer. And your knowledge of the mayor and his personality, and I guess your gut about whether or not we would get along. Your confidence in me was very important, but I think obviously your vote of confidence meant a lot to the boss. How did you meet the mayor? I know you go back a long way.
We do, and I'll tell you, it goes back to when he was on city council. As I think you know, Kapel, I'm the longtime chair of the board of the Coalition for the Homeless. And when the mayor was on city council, he was really one of the members who was the best at addressing issues of poverty, homelessness, and other questions. And it was really rare because that's not a big, well-known voting block. And I thought he was so smart and committed to try to do something about issues of poverty and wealth. I really respected that and got to know him well. Then I worked with him when he was in the public advocate's office and so on. So I really got to know the mayor well back in the early days.
You know, as with most public figures, his personality in public when people see him at these press conferences and what we see knowing the man himself in some ways is similar, but in some ways I think he's portrayed in a very simplistic way when actually he's a very complicated person like all human beings and someone I've found to be not only intellectually very, very smart, but just a really interesting person. And I think oftentimes the press misses that nuance about him because all they see him in is these press conferences and people get amount to 2-3 second sound bites and don't really have the pleasure of knowing him in person. You and I both have had that opportunity. Can you tell us a little bit about your impressions of the mayor as a person?
I'm happy to do that. And I think that's so true. And I often say it, that if people were in a room alone with the mayor, they would see a side of him that they don't often see and come to respect and like him so much more because you really get to know who he is as a person. I've always respected that the mayor says what he means and means what he says. He has the courage of his convictions. And I remember when he was running for this office, well over 8 years ago, and he was at 4% in the polls, and nobody really knew him, I would introduce him to different groups. And he'd always say before speaking to them, what do you think is important to them? And I said, well, obviously you have your views, but these particular issues are important, and I would stress this aspect of your platform. And he would always ignore my advice 100%, say what he means, what he believes in, what he thinks he should, you know, do if he gets elected. And I think people came away respected that he came to a group that didn't necessarily share those views, but he argued passionately and effectively. And I think we've seen that certainly in his tenure, that he continues to you know, have the courage to act on what he believes in. The other piece is people don't realize his warmer side. And I've gotten to know the mayor well and the family. He's gotten to know my family well. And my son, who's now almost 10, got to know him when he was young. And he saw this tall public official who was so nice to him and was really taken by it that he got this very tall stuffed animal. And he decided to call it Mayor de Blasio, which is still his favorite stuffed animal. So on many nights at my home, you'll hear us say, where's Mayor de Blasio? And people can misunderstand what we're saying in the halls of our building, but we're talking about a very favorite stuffed animal. And I think that says a lot.
So Barry, as Capel mentioned, you played a key role in the Trump impeachment hearings. How did you come to the attention of Chairman Nadler?
Well, that's a great question. And you know, it was an unusual time in history where there was an intersection of my expertise in criminal law and presidential conduct, and was asked to come down at various points of Congress, even before the House switched from Republican to Democrat, before 2018, just to help some of the members and committees understand some of the issues that they were looking at. There were issues of obstruction and collusion, tax returns. So I met along with my colleague Norm Eisen, who I've known forever, and we met with many members of Congress and the committee to help them understand these issues. And we realized that there really was a dearth of understanding of how ordinary people would be treated if they engaged in some of the conduct that the president at the time was alleged to have engaged in. So based on that, we decided to write some public reports. We wrote a very long 200 plus page report for Brookings, two volumes, that addressed presidential obstruction of justice. We also did one on collusion, election finance crimes, and it was as much to help educate Congress, reporters, and the like of just how everyday people are treated if they engage in that type of conduct.
Do you think the report was a significant reason why Chairman Nadler chose you?
Well, I wouldn't say that, but I would say it was part of a process. And, you know, we had a variety of meetings. We've got to know the members of Congress. And the initial meetings were not with Chairman Nadler, because Congressman Conyers was the original ranking minority. So over time, we got to know many members of Congress, including Chairman Nadler. And again, I was honored when he asked. I had no plans to leave the greatest city in the world or my family or practice, but I did feel a true call to service. That it was a unique time and the most important thing that I could do to help protect the institutions we hold dear and the future for my children was to go down and try to do what we can to make sure that the rule of law was upheld and the Congress took the appropriate steps based on the evidence we found.
So something that's interesting about the report is Ukraine is only mentioned 13 times. However, in your opening statement in the hearing, Ukraine became a central part of the hearing. Were you surprised based on the report at how much additional evidence you uncovered?
I would say yes and no. You know, we spent a lot of time investigating sort of what's known as the Russia conduct and the president's actions around that. And for a whole variety of reasons, I think people were deeply troubled by it. The facts ultimately came out and showed that there were crimes that anyone else could would likely be prosecuted for. But for a variety of reasons, I don't think it was sufficient to persuade enough members of the House, including the so-called frontliners who had been elected in formerly Republican districts or purple districts, and really wanted to see compelling proof. But I remember on the Friday before the whistleblower information actually became known, I was meeting with the House Judiciary members, and we were talking about where we were. At that point, the president had gone to extraordinary lengths to block us. He went to court to prevent us from talking to Don McGahn, who he directed to create phony documents. And we were really having a hard time with getting the evidence and witnesses so the American people and other members of Congress could understand the extent of the misconduct. And I said to our members, based on the investigation you've done with Russia, you have brought the Congress to the edge of the runway. Because at that point, close to 100 members of the caucus had come out in favor of impeachment. And I said, in my experience, most people who do bad things and don't respect the law continue to do that. And whether it's the whistleblower complaint that we just had word of but didn't know the details or something else, if there's other misconduct, the only place for Congress to go is to take off, because there's no more room in the runway to give him the benefit of the doubt, and there'll be no other choice. And sure enough, the following week, we learned more details about Ukraine, and then the Congress was persuaded. And it was also significant. Ukraine was not unrelated. If you remember, the call to President Zelensky of Ukraine was the day after Robert Mueller testified, and the president told President Zelensky that he thought he was in the clear. So it shows the pattern of misconduct. And as I said in my opening statement to the House Judiciary Committee and the impeachment hearings, that if President Trump is able to get away with his conduct, the only limit to what he might do next is our imagination. And it's the same idea of why we had to take the steps that we did.
Let's talk a little bit about that opening. Did you write that opening statement yourself?
I believe when trying a case that the opening statement has to overtake you, that you know the facts and law, that there is a message that you need to give that is the right message. So, yes, I sat down, as I do with all my opening statements, I wrote it myself. And I wrote, you know, what I thought was most important. One of the things is everybody wanted to say in the Republican side, oh, they just don't like the president. They don't like him. They don't like his personality. That's why they're doing it. So that's why I wanted to begin with saying it's not whether he is a good person or not. That has nothing to do with why we're here. We're here because he, in fact, engaged in conduct that the framers made very clear was the worst type of misconduct that is clearly impeachable and should be impeachable for the reasons we talked about. Now, I will tell you, I certainly got input from my wonderful colleagues who were there. And again, I think they helped me recognize that it wasn't simply giving the strongest opening, but it was an opening that could appeal to all sorts of people, including people who didn't necessarily agree with me when I began. So I would say that the opening I gave was a different opening that I might not have liked quite as much as the original opening I drafted, but I thought it was the better opening to give because it allowed for more people to come on board and understand the significance of what we were saying and why the conduct was so harmful to our country.
Who is the audience you're targeting? Was it the American people? Did you think there was any chance you were going to swing any Republicans at that time? Was it making sure that the Dems remained unified?
All of the above. Right. And like in any good case, you want to know, do you have the goods? And I knew we had the goods. We had the facts. We had the support that this was a trifecta of presidential misconduct. The ABCs that the framers were most concerned about, abuse of power, betrayal of the national trust and security, and corruption of elections. And we had the facts to show that's what happened. The president said it in his own words. So I knew we had the goods.
When I worked in Congress, I worked for somebody, Elijah Cummings, who was a master of Congress, and he knew how to use witnesses to make a point. He would often tell me that his Republican colleagues may not understand or be willing to listen to him, but he would use the witnesses to convey in a very public way why he believed his point of view was correct, because it would force the other side to grapple with the issues in a way that they otherwise wouldn't do so in private. He would often say that, unlike a courtroom, he said, there's not a lot of substance that happens in these hearings. You're looking for that 10-second bite that the media is going to get to try to explain to the American public what's happening and why this person is here and why this hearing is important. How did you think through in crafting your opening so that when somebody turned it on, they were actually willing to listen beyond the first 20 seconds versus, you know, balancing that with the seriousness that this matter deserved?
Well, I would say they really fit together perfectly because on the one, it had to be substantive and important enough so it felt real and supported the arguments. It had to be compelling enough for everyone or people don't listen. And it has to sort of cut through simply the argument. He did this, it's bad. It has to reach a higher level where people understand the significance and why it really matters. And one of the things that I take pride in that we were able to do in Congress, when I went down there, I started talking about the need to use demonstratives to help explain this better. And in Congress, I was told by many other staffers that we don't call them demonstratives, we call them props. And I'm like, no, we are never calling them props again. Props are magic tricks. Demonstratives are things that help demonstrate the points we want to make. We're not holding up cardboard boards. We're using video. We're going to use electronic discovery like in the courtroom. So one of the things I tried to do in the opening is to bring the witnesses in by using video clips of the witnesses, of the president himself, of using demonstratives to help build the point. Because again, the goal is we did believe the evidence was overwhelming.
You mentioned demonstratives. You know, you showed video clips throughout the hearing. You referenced Corey Lewandowski's book, text messages, so much evidence. I often find, you know, watching the news to be depressing. How did you kind of deal with just the news you had to watch, the books you had to read, the text messages you had to read, the news stories? Just how did you deal with all that?
Well, it's a good question. And again, at times it risked being overwhelming because we did not have the type of staff that existed in prior impeachment proceedings. We were sort of a very lean team and everybody was working around the clock. I don't know that I've ever gone as long with as little sleep, but we felt, you know, moved by the task at hand and the significance of it. But, you know, it's interesting. And again, I think that is one of the advantages of being a trial lawyer, because it became a bit of a running joke. At times people would say, and throughout Congress, oh, that was such a great hearing you had. It was so significant what you've done. I saw it on MSNBC, CNN for 48 hours. You were on the front page of the Times and the Post. And I would always say, I'd say, well, that's all good and well, but you know what I like? And it became a running joke, because the answer is what I like is I like winning. So let's figure out how what we did, does that actually help us move down a path to victory towards impeachment if we thought that's what was justified and not just the coverage? Because again, Congress, by definition, being a political body, is very tactical. How does what we do today affect the news tomorrow, the polls tomorrow, the public's perception tomorrow? To actually be able to do something like what we did, you need to be more strategic and play a longer game. So I thought that was also something that I could bring from my perspective as a trial lawyer and not so much as a political person, but more of an outsider, and I've tried to do that.
Yeah, and so you mentioned you like winning. At the end of the day, do you think you won?
I think you have to define winning. I don't think we won in the sense that ultimately, I don't think the Senate Republicans did the right thing other than Mitt Romney. And I say that about two things. One, obviously, everyone has to vote their conscience, but they knew that they should have let us call witnesses. We had John Bolton. There was ample precedent, and people said the things that would have allowed us to bring more of the facts that ultimately came out to the trial. So I think that was the wrong vote. And I also think their actual vote on the evidence was hard to justify. But all that being said, what I think we were able to accomplish is we were able to bring before the American people the full scope of the president's conduct. I think it allowed the American people to evaluate his conduct in the context of things that followed. I wrote an op-ed for the New York Times about how the president's action in response to coronavirus is exactly what he did in response to the Ukraine, in terms of how he asked the governors for favors in exchange for providing relief, how he criticized those whose ideas he thought would hurt his reelections, how so much of his conduct was motivated by a desire to serve his personal and political interests as opposed to the interests of the nation. And I think the American people were more skeptical of his comments and his actions because of what we did.
What surprised you most about your experience on the Hill?
Well, what surprised me the most is how much I didn't know. But I learned that, you know, how Congress works is actually creates all sorts of issues, good and bad, that you have to deal with to accomplish things. And, you know, Nancy Pelosi, who I got to know and see firsthand, you know, really is a master at working so many of the levers. But I came to understand better the challenges faced in accomplishing things in the House, but also the potential for getting things done. And I walked away with such great respect for so many of the members who I got to work with on the committee, the Senate, the House managers for the Senate trial, and part of the leadership and others. So at the end of the day, I think I did not expect to get as much of an education as I did in the political process. It wasn't exactly Mr. Smith goes to Washington, but it was a New York trial lawyer goes to Washington, and it was a story unto itself.
We'll be right back with more from our conversation with Barry Burke. But I want to take a second to remind our listeners to get tested for COVID-19. And remember, tests are free. Text COVID-TEST to 85548 or visit nyc.gov/COVID-TEST to find a convenient testing site near you. I also want to remind our New York City public school families that even when school buildings are closed, meals are still available. Find a Meals Hub site near you at schools.nyc.gov/free meals. Back to you, Capel.
As a trial lawyer, whether you're a Democrat or Republican, when you look at the facts, these are some strong facts supporting the articles of impeachment. I don't think anybody could objectively argue otherwise. Yet, that is indeed what the Republicans, at least in public, argued. What were the Republicans saying to you in private?
Well, you know, it's interesting. I think We did have dialogue with the Republicans, and I think there's clear a private view of the president that is different from what they were saying publicly. And I think what was so distressing is the view that so many of these members of Congress, both the House and the Senate, knew better. And they knew what the president was doing. They knew it was wrong, but they were afraid. There were so few profiles in courage where people were prepared to stand up. Mitt Romney was so interested in trying to understand the facts. He was a profile in courage. He stood up and created the first bipartisan vote to remove a president in the history of our country. But others who are now speaking out, you know, Senator Ben Sasse and others who were saying what the president is doing is wrong. I wonder where they were during impeachment. Why weren't they speaking out? Others who could have said much more, who could have said, let's hear the witnesses, who could have done more to defend our institutions and the guardrail, were so fearful of an angry tweet by the president that they wouldn't do that. So I really think that the framers, they did anticipate we could have a president who violated all norms, and the solution to that was to impeach him. I don't think the framers envisioned we could have a president who did, in fact, abuse his power to such a degree, but that we would have another body, a Senate, that would be complicit in allowing it to happen. So I think that is a challenge for our country going forward, and that is a surprise. It was a great disappointment to me.
How much convincing did it really take for the members to agree that counsel should have a significant role in these proceedings?
I think what was very valuable is early on in the Judiciary Committee proceedings, we passed impeachment procedures that allowed for counsel to question for 30 minutes. And the House was, our members were very supportive of me. They realized that's what I do, and that's why I was there. In fact, I was supposed to question Bill Barr when he first came down after releasing the summary of the Mueller report that was so misleading, we would say. And they said, given who Barr is, we should have counsel who can question him for an extended period of time. And then Barr said, I will not come before the committee. I will deny the members the right to question if you're going to have counsel, because I don't think counsel should question. And members to a person said, we're not backing down. The attorney general can't tell us how to run the committee. Barry's going to question, and if he doesn't want to come, that's on him. And again, I so respected that decision. It could have gone either way. I didn't know that they necessarily needed to die on that hill, but I respected that decision, and I think that support continued throughout. So when it came to witnesses, and you take it again, like when we had witnesses like a Corey Lewandowski, not only were the members limited to 5 minutes, but because the president and the administration had relied and invoked these bogus privileges, absolute immunity for people like Don McGahn and others, and even for Corey Lewandowski, who did not work a single day in the White House, they claimed executive privilege. So it allowed him to hide behind the executive privilege of the members, not answer the questions, run out the 5 minutes, be, you know, antagonistic to all our members. So to have 30 minutes to be able to question him at the end, which, again, I'm used to questioning witnesses for days, so to have 30 minutes was a challenge, but I was thrilled to have the chance to actually reveal who this person was and that he knew he was doing the president's criminal bidding when the president asked him to send a message to Attorney General Sessions to not investigate the president and to threaten to fire him if he ignored that advice.
Yeah, and it's all about impeaching the credibility of that witness at the end of the day and, by inference, the credibility of the entire case. And when you were crossing, so to speak, witnesses, including Lewandowski, is that the mindset with which you were working sort of under? Was that what you were trying to do, in essence, was to expose the hypocrisy, expose the contradictions, expose the inconsistencies?
You asked exactly the right question, because, again, you have to remember what your goal is, because it's easy to just say, I want to beat up on a Corey Lewandowski or another witness. But the goal really is to help the American people see that the president did something that was wrong and criminal and use the witness who you're facing to establish those points. But I'll tell you, I'll go back. You talked about how Elijah Cummings said that in Congress there can be moments that actually have greater resonance than you'd expect. Similarly, I was teed up to question Corey Lewandowski at the end. It would be the first lawyer questioning in our impeachment process. The Republicans on our committee, they objected under every ground you can imagine. And it was quite a scene where everybody was huddled over the chairman, Jerry Nadler. In fact, it was a big article in the New York Times with a picture of everybody huddled around them that looked like a Renaissance painting, fighting about me. Finally, Jerry Nadler's chief of staff, the great Amy Rutkin, said, Barry, we're just going to call on you. Are you ready? I'm like, Amy, I've been ready for 4 months. This is what I do. and then I was ready for him because I knew that the evidence was overwhelming, that he knew he had committed crimes, that he lied about it on TV, that he hid what he did. And the reason he did it, that he sought immunity before going and meeting with Mueller because he knew the president had committed crimes and used him to do it. So that was the point. It was 30 minutes. And it was honestly, it was one of the easiest 30 minutes of cross because I had the goods. And we at that point, we had the demonstratives and everything else, and I felt great about doing it at the end. But I will tell you, I did not appreciate for a moment how significant it would be received. In fact, that night I had a long planned dinner that was important. I went out, and I was also helping members of Congress deal with a variety of things. So I was on the phone and even while we're dinner and till late. So I really was not following the news. And then I got a call late at night and said, you know, you're all over the news tonight. And then you have over something like, you know, close to a million views of your Corey Lewandowski. Then it was, you know, well over a million. And I really can honestly say I had no conception that that's how it would be perceived, because to me, I was doing what I always do, and that's to cross-examine a witness to make a point. But I was happy that it got the attention it did because it did a couple of different things. It helped to establish that, in fact, the president surrounded him with people who were looking to help him carry out his wrongful activity. It also showed, I think, the value of the process going forward of what extended questioning could allow happen. And I think it was very useful in the intel hearings when the committee did such a good job walking through those witnesses, and we worked with them to help them in that process. And it helped us in our hearings when we could do the same.
When you were meeting with White House counsel, was that lawyer to lawyer, or were the congressmen and women involved in that as well?
It was lawyer to lawyer. Mm-hmm. So we would literally go over to the White House. We'd run into people like Kellyanne Conway, who would say, oh, well, tell the president you were here and send him your regards. So, you know, the sort of the backstory of just what the process is. And again, that was when, you know, the courts, when we were fighting for witnesses, require there to be an accommodation process. So under the law, you're required to try to work out some of the legal issues before you run to court. So that's why we were legally obligated to see if we could make any compromises. But under that White House, there was no compromise. And I didn't blame the lawyers for that.
So Barry, during the trial, your role was very public. During the process of impeachment, you of course were questioning witnesses, you did the opening statement for the Democrats, and then after the articles of impeachment were filed, we of course moved over to the Senate. Can you talk about your role during the trial?
So after the House voted to impeach the president, voted out articles of impeachment, the next step is the trial in the Senate. So the House, and this is Speaker Pelosi, selects who the House managers would be to actually prosecute the case in the Senate for the removal of the president. The rules of the Senate, which carried over from Clinton, were that only members could be House managers, which we totally respected. And when Speaker Pelosi asked Norm and me to work to help the managers, we were more than happy to do it, to help make it as meaningful as could be. Thought I could bring what I would call trial magic, you know, because we were having 24 hours of evidence presentation. Some days were 8-9 hours. That is mind-numbing. So how do you bring trial magic to make it come to life? How do you make it like something people would want to watch on TV? And that really is the key to that, is bringing in the demonstratives that can make it all come to life. So, you know, one of the things that I worked so hard on is how to tell our stories in a compelling way through our managers, to have them tell their stories, but also to bring it alive with bring the witnesses into the Senate and the like. And I'll tell you, one of the big fights when the House was going back and forth with Mitch McConnell in his office and Chuck Schumer about what would happen, there was initial resistance from McConnell to have TVs to allow us to use these demonstratives. And ultimately, I think the compromise, what we got were these really small TVs, old TVs that, although the, you know, Senate chamber is much smaller than the House chamber, they were very hard to see. But for us, being able to show it in the Senate meant that the networks would and cable would put it on TV so that they could come alive in for the American people. And then ultimately, the senators, principally the Republican senators, complained that they couldn't see the TV. So before everyone, we passed out our demonstratives in hard copy as well. And so many of the Republicans said, gee, they hadn't been following the facts so closely. So they didn't know many of the things that we presented, the witnesses, the charts, the timelines. So I felt very good about that. And honestly, it was just an honor to work with so many skilled lawyers from all across Congress, from various committees who came to help and support our efforts.
you used to sit at the table in the chamber, correct? So oftentimes on TV, you'd see the House managers make their statement, and then they would come back and they would start whispering with people like you. What were you all talking about? Was it strategy? Was it, you know, that was really great, but you should have, you can add X, Y, Z, or sort of, can you take us to that table and some of the discussions that were happening?
It's a good question. And, you know, one of the challenges being down there as in any trial is not to take the bait, right? Because we were trying our case to prove to the senators and the American people the conduct that took place and the evidence of it that was so overwhelming. And because we had the goods, so often the White House would come up with just outrageous arguments through their counsel. They would argue facts that were just counterproductive, that had nothing to do with the evidence. And it was so tempting to want to respond to each one of those points because there was so much evidence that was so overwhelming, but it would interrupt what we were doing. So much of it is saying, we can show that's wrong by pulling up 14 documents that we have right here. Or should we just continue and look at the long game and not the immediate gratification? And so often it was, let's not do it. Occasionally we said, we have to do it. But then when Alan Dershowitz, who I was my evidence professor at Harvard Law School in the late 80s, when he argued that the president could always ask a foreign leader to do something inappropriate. Because if the president thinks that it's in the country's interest for him to be reelected, it's always, you know, done for an innocent reason. That just can't be right. And how could you leave that? And ultimately, you know, we didn't see him for the rest of the trial after that.
We've spoken a lot about the proceedings, but in terms of the articles of impeachment themselves, how involved were you in drafting those articles of impeachment?
It was very much a collaborative process and an iterative process. You know, we were talking in judiciary because the judiciary has responsibility for drafting and passing the articles in consultation with leadership and others like Adam Schiff was actively involved. And when we identified all the possible articles of impeachment, you know, we're in double figures, right? So the challenge was to narrow. And I will say some of the hardest decisions were, do we bring in the Russia investigation as separate articles or not? And part of it is because of how President Trump has treated this, the amount of time. They felt like older charges, and there were questions of whether to include them or not. Also because the Ukraine did really follow on the heels of Russia. You know, when in Russia, when President Trump said, you know, Russia, if you're listening, there are 50,000 Hillary Clinton emails, and 5 hours later, they tried to hack her computer to get them, is akin to what he was asking President Zelensky. The obstruction in Russia echoed the obstruction in Ukraine. So it was all together, and there was a lot of back and forth, including legal principles, which I had a lot of input in the things to share about legally what to do. And ultimately, the compromise was reached where we focused on Ukraine, but talked about the pattern evidence, the pattern being Russia. And I think everybody, you know, sort of recognized the value in that. And it was a very productive discussion. People came out from different views. You know, the judiciary was in favor of including Russia, mostly, as was Jerry Nadler, but we recognized the pros and cons of it. And we all were very comfortable with these articles and how it was presented.
One of my roles during the COVID-19 pandemic has been drafting emergency executive orders. Since the start of the pandemic, we've drafted 55. We were limiting large gatherings. We closed restaurants and other businesses. And during that time, I often thought, this is a moment that is going to change the city and have implications far and wide. When you were drafting your opening statement and reviewing evidence, did you think that this was going to be a moment in history that your son and your children would read and learn about?
You know, it's so interesting. And I will tell you, so many times, sometimes it would be midnight and I'm walking, you know, to the Capitols and I'm passing all the statutes and the history. I'm like, I know I should stop and pause and recognize how cool this is, how historical this is, how important. I'm like, but we have too much to do. You know, every day we're walking through the House chambers to the Senate, to the like, we're walking back and forth, we're working on things that we know are going to be important. And I would say, I should pause for a second just to soak in the moment to remember it. But I said, but I can't, we don't have time. And I mean, I will tell you, you know, the moment that we had our big presentations, we had problems with some of the demonstratives because at the time it was a new process up until 15 minutes before we went live on TV. And if you stop and think, wow, this is sort of a big deal. If our demonstratives are not working, it's going to affect your ability to fix the problem. We had one focus, and that is the task at hand, which everyone recognized was so important, and everybody was completely committed to that. So while there was a recognition that we should, you know, take a moment to note the historical significance, I don't think really that's something that we did so much.
Have you reflected about that moment now?
Well, I think what I've reflected back is the decisions we made, and I get asked regularly, what do I think about impeachment? And again, I feel very grateful that we were able to do what we were able to accomplish to help the American people see the president's conduct for what I think it was and evaluate what he is doing today and the job he's done in the White House in making decisions as the ultimate juror in the election and also evaluating what happened after that process. So I think it was a service that was very important, and I feel, again, very proud to have been part of it and grateful for that opportunity.
So Barry, I think I want to finish by asking, you know, when the story of this impeachment process is told 50 years, 100 years from now, the same way we look back at Nixon and the same way we look back at Clinton, how do you hope your role in particular is remembered?
I do think, and I feel to my core, that this was a moment in history where our system was tested, where institutions were under such pressure, where our institutional guardrails were brought down in a way that exposed some of the faults of our system. Things that people thought as being ingrained in our structural system and constitution were recognized as really being practices that people respected on both parties throughout the founding of our country, that now we have to make sure that this cannot be repeated, that what we experienced is a cautionary tale going forward. And for our children and grandchildren, we have to make sure that our institutions are strong and that we never allow our key principles and rule of law to be compromised. So to me, that's what I hope comes out of this. And to the extent that I was able to play some part in helping to expose it, I feel good about that.
I want to thank our guest today, Barry Burke, not only an eminent trial lawyer, but I am honored to say a dear friend of our country. Was very lucky to have you there during the impeachment trial. In that moment, you made all of us proud, and I think you made the country proud.
Thank you so much, Capel. It was my honor to do it, and thank you for all of you for everything you're doing for our city and to bring it back and to help let people live their lives, whether it's going out to sit outside and have food at restaurants or doing other things that you're making possible through all your hard work. Great decisions. Thank you.
I want to thank my friend Barry Burke again for taking the time to join us on City Hall Pass. New Yorkers should feel incredibly proud that one of our own was chosen to serve in such a high profile and impactful role during the impeachment hearings. We really hope you enjoyed this conversation and look forward to you joining us next week for another episode of City Hall Pass. Thanks for listening.
This podcast is brought to you by the Office of the Counsel to the Mayor of New York City, with support from the Mayor's Office of Media and Entertainment. Special thanks to our executive producer, Stathi, and a big thank you to Karen, Roland, Jenna, and Andrew from the Mayor's Office of Media and Entertainment. We couldn't do this without you.